Thank you for downloading this full-length message by Chuck Swindoll. Did you know that our free mobile app gives you a growing number of Chuck's messages in the same full-length format? To download the app, visit insight.org/app.
What marks a person for greatness? And while I'm asking, is it preeminence or intellectual, artistic, professional, maybe political endeavors? Think about that. Is it leaving a mark that endures into the future? Or is it measured by character? Of all the great men and women in history, Daniel certainly ranks as one of the greatest. He reached the pinnacle of political endeavors, serving under 8 kings, and the mark he left has endured for some 25 centuries. Just stop and think about that. 25 centuries. And I believe he was truly great because he was exactly the person he appeared to be, transparent, honest, dedicated to God, and loyal to those whom he served. He was truly a man of integrity. I want to read the story that represents perhaps his greatest challenge as recorded in Daniel chapter 6. I'll be reading verses 1 to 16 from The Message. Listen carefully. Darius reorganized his kingdom. He appointed 120 governors to administer all the parts of his realm. Over them were 3 vice regents, one of whom was Daniel. The governors reported to the vice regents, who made sure that everything was in order for the king. But Daniel, brimming with spirit and intelligence, so completely outclassed the other vice regents and governors that the king decided to put him in charge of the whole kingdom. The vice regents and governors got together to find some old scandal or skeleton in Daniel's life that they could use against him. But they couldn't dig up anything. He was totally exemplary and trustworthy. They could find no evidence of negligence or misconduct. So they finally gave up and said, "We're never going to find anything against this Daniel unless we can cook up something religious." The vice regents and governors conspired together and then went to the king and said, "King Darius, live forever. We've convened your vice regents, governors, and all your leading officials, and have agreed that the king should issue the following decree. For the next 30 days, no one is to pray to any god or mortal except you, O king. Anyone who disobeys will be thrown into the lion's den. Issue this decree, O king, and make it unconditional, as if written in stone, like all the laws of the Medes and the Persians." King Darius signed the decree. When Daniel learned that the decree had been signed and posted, he continued to pray just as he had always done. His house had windows in the upstairs that opened toward Jerusalem. 3 times a day he knelt there in prayer, thanking and praising his God. The conspirators came and found him praying, asking God for help. They went straight to the king and reminded him of the royal decree that he had signed. "Did you not," they said, "sign a decree forbidding anyone to pray to any god or man except you for the next 30 days? And anyone caught doing it would be thrown into the lion's den?" "Absolutely," said the king, "written in stone, like all the laws of the Medes and the Persians." Then they said, "Daniel, one of the Jewish exiles, ignores you, O king, and defies your decree. 3 times a day he prays." At this, the king was very upset and tried his best to get Daniel out of the fix he had put him in. He worked at it the whole day long. But then the conspirators were back. "Remember, O king, it's the law of the Medes and Persians that the king's decree can never be changed." The king caved in and ordered Daniel brought and thrown into the lion's den. But he said to Daniel, "Your God, to whom you are so loyal, is going to get you out of this."
In the Bible, there are some stories that are so familiar, we have given them a title. And just the mention of part of that title is all we need to complete it. For example, let me have you help me with a few of them. All right, let's see how we do. Noah and the ark. Well, that's not bad. Samson and Delilah. Good. David and Goliath. Okay. Elijah under the juniper tree was the answer. All right. Jonah and the whale. The patience of Moses crossing. The destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, Daniel and... Now, isn't that interesting? The book of Daniel is full of 12 chapters of events and stories and whatever about his life, but the most familiar to us is Daniel in the lion's den. I remember as a little boy in Sunday school, when they kept me quiet enough to listen, hearing the story of Daniel in the lion's den, two things bothered me very much. First of all, who threw him in a place like that? And second, what had he done that was so bad that they put him in a dungeon of where the king of the jungle lived? And I wondered seriously about that because there's one thing I did not want to do, and that was something that bad, to be put in a place like that. As I got older and began to study the story myself, to my surprise, I found out that Daniel was not in the lion's den because of something he did wrong, but because of something he did right. And that confused me all the more. As a matter of fact, it still confuses Christians today. We are under the impression that when you do what is wrong, you ought to be punished for it. But when you do what is right, you ought to be rewarded for it. Now that makes good, logical, common sense, but it isn't always true. Sometime when you do what is wrong, you're rewarded for it, as far as this world is concerned. And occasionally when you do what is right, you pay a terrible price for it. I had a man come to me following a service last Sunday morning and convey to me how he had done what was right, how he had lived up in his work to his convictions, and he stood by his guns, believing what he was doing was right. And as he conveyed it, he had been very wise, he had been very careful, and very consistent in doing what was right. But the very next morning, he faced the threat of losing his job because of doing what was right. That was his lion's den. It made such an impression on me to follow up on why Daniel went where he did that I decided we needed to spend an evening, especially with the number of children we have here this evening, to come to a realization of what had caused Daniel to go through the lion's den. Because I feel that what brought it on is a far more significant thing than the experience in the lion's den itself. So in Daniel chapter 6, where the story is found, let's turn. Now some of you will remember last Sunday evening, others of you were not here, so you may not know what brought about this chapter 6. So look at the previous two verses. The last two verses of chapter 5. The same night Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. And he was slain by the armies of the Medes and the Persians. And the king of the Medes is mentioned here by name. Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. So here was a man in his early 60s who became a king over a land and set up a new dynasty. Now, if you've really got a good memory, you can go back to chapter 2 in Daniel and remember that all of this was prophesied. We read there that the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar, the kingdom of Babylon, was a kingdom of pictured as a golden head on the statue. But as an inferior kingdom came along, there would be a breakdown in governmental procedures. And the second kingdom that was to be over the land of Israel was the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians. They were inferior. I think it's interesting that in the first two verses of chapter 6, we immediately see an inferior form of government. The very best form of government is a monarchy, not a democracy, though I may be misunderstood and misquoted in saying that. The kind of government that is best is the government that Jesus will establish when he comes back to this earth, where he will reign as the supreme King of kings and Lord of lords. He has at his disposal all forms of government, and he chooses a monarchy. Of course, he can choose that because he is perfect. You see, that's where the monarchy breaks down. If the king is imperfect, the people become burdened and overworked and overtaxed and misused. But if the king is godly, it is the finest form of government. However, when the Medes and the Persians took over, there was an instant change from an absolute monarchy to a delegation of authority. Notice the first verse. It seemed good to the king, Darius, to appoint 120 satraps. We don't know what that word means because we do not use it today. Some translations have rendered it governors, others overseers. These were 120 men who shared in the authority over the kingdom. They were governmental officials who served over the kingdom, and they were in charge of the whole kingdom. Darius set up 120 assistants to whom he delegated the authority of responsibility. However, as soon as authority is delegated, you run the risk of corruption. And that's exactly what he feared. And so he set over those 120 a second echelon nearer to his authority, which are called in this second verse commissioners. Some renderings handle it as presidents. I think commissioners is better than president. Over those 120 men, there were three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps or governors might be accountable to them and that the king might not suffer loss. Now, the second verse clearly reveals why those men were established in government. They were over the 120. Those 120 governors were accountable to those three men. Furthermore, it was a guard against a ripoff, frankly. Those 120 governors could make off with a lot of taxation, with a lot of illegal revenue, with payola, and all sorts of illegal acts. And so these three men, who were apparently the most trusted in the kingdom, just under the king, were given authority over the whole governorship. Now, notice in verse 2 that Daniel was one of them. Daniel, by this time, is in his 80s. That ought to encourage some people here tonight who are approaching that wonderful young age of 80. Daniel wasn't shelved. He wasn't a useless, retired, dust-collecting, rocking chair type of person. He was involved. Daniel was one of the three highest men in the land. He not only had seniority, he had superiority over these others. Look at verse 3. Then this Daniel, began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and among the governors because he possessed an extraordinary spirit. And the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Now I want you to study verse 3 with your eyes. In our world, it's not what you know, it's who you know that usually brings about a promotion. But in God's world, it's what you are, not who you know, not even who you are. It's what you are as a person. And God saw fit in the integrity of Daniel's life to move in the heart of the king to plan a promotion. Notice this extraordinary spirit. The Berkeley version calls it a surpassing spirit. Now, our tendency is to think in terms of the spiritual life, that he was a spirit-filled man. That's true, but I don't take it to mean that here. I take it to mean an excellent attitude, the first mark of integrity in the life of Daniel. Now, if you want to be a person of integrity, and we hear a lot about integrity these days, and that's good, the place to begin is within your own attitude. It's so easy to build a sham around our lives and to look as though our attitude is good, when in reality it isn't. And one of the first places it shows up is in the realm of our work. I think it's significant that there was no jealousy in Daniel's heart over those other two men who were appointed as commissioners. Now you remember, he could have been threatened, he could have been competitive, he could have been rather nasty and ugly in his responsibilities because he had had the longest time in the kingdom. Long before those men had even come on the scene, he had been an authority under Nebuchadnezzar. But because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Let me ask you about your attitude tonight. How is it? Now, it's good tonight, most of you. But what about tomorrow morning when you punch in? Or what about by the end of the day, tomorrow evening? How will your 8 to 10 hours have been? As you work shoulder to shoulder with people in your shop or in your office or in the sales force where you're employed or among the secretaries, what kind of attitude will you have? Attitude means so much. Now, I'll tell you, you might wonder, will my superior notice if I have a good attitude? Don't worry about that. He'll stumble all over it. He'll be amazed by it. In fact, he'll be terribly impressed. Your trouble won't come from your superior. Your trouble will come from your fellow workers, who are often lazy, who are often dishonest, and they're troubled that you're not also. And because you won't be like they are, you will discover they will become envious and they will become jealous. And you might even experience something of what Daniel experienced. Well, let's read on. Look at the plot that was held against him, or took place against him. First, there were these attempted accusations. Then the commissioners, that is the other two, Daniel's peers, and the governors, the satraps, began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. Now, isn't that significant? Here is a man who is doing a job. He is an excellent attitude. He's an extraordinary spirit. He's serving under God in the responsibility of official government work under Darius. And he's doing apparently a splendid job, and his peers, those who are working around him, set up a spying program against him. They begin to search for some alleged accusations, some real accusations against him. It says that they searched in the area of government affairs. And what did they find? Well, the verse says they could find no ground of accusation. They could find no evidence of corruption. Wow. How would you like your work to come under that kind of scrutiny? Where you make a living, not the way you are on Sunday, but the place where you make your wage. How would you be able to hold up if, for some reason, question came on your character and they began to investigate your work? What would they find? Would it make you nervous? Would you have to burn or destroy or hide some of the skeletons you've tucked away in the closets? Daniel was investigated to see if they could find anything with regard to his work. That's government affairs. That was his realm of occupation. And the remarkable thing is, they could not find one ground of accusation. They could not find one evidence of corruption. And that's not only remarkable, that sounds today like it's impossible. Some of us are going through a time of real rethinking government matters. We who love this country and love it dearly and would fight to our last day to preserve it are becoming increasingly more jealous for integrity at the higher echelon of our government. And I think it speaks with real relevance as it says this man was not found guilty of accusation or corruption. Why? Well, here's the second mark of integrity, because he was faithful in his work. Now, be careful here. We often use the word faithful only as it relates to the spiritual life, the religious life, but it's not talking about faithfulness at church or in the temple or in worship. They were investigating his government affairs. They're talking about his faithfulness at work. So much of our time spent in the Word of God from Sunday to Sunday is spent in a very small section of our lives. Not enough time is spent from this pulpit talking about the realm of work where you spend most of your hours. And this passage says that when Daniel was investigated, he was found to be faithful in his work. The Berkeley says, in the discharge of his official duties. Look at Proverbs 20, verses 6 and 7. I don't know, but perhaps some of you came tonight for this very reason, to give yourself a chance to do some analysis in the way you're carrying on in your work. Let's do that this evening. Proverbs 20, verse 6 tells the truth. Many a woman proclaims his own loyalty, but who can find a trustworthy man, a trustworthy woman? It's asked with the answer in mind, it's rare. Only rarely will you find one that is completely trustworthy. I've had a man tell me that in his business, it isn't the public that gives him trouble, it's the employee. It isn't the public that takes his goods, it's those that work for him that rip off the goods that they are to be selling. It's come to the place where many an employer will no longer hire a Christian. As a matter of fact, when we were living in Texas, we were close friends with the president of a bank. And the highest risk were the preachers. Isn't that significant? Those that gave him most difficulty were those who were engaged continually in the things of God. Now listen and appraise your personal life. Are you trustworthy? Can they count on you to get the job done when the boss isn't there? The verse goes on to say, a righteous man who walks in his integrity, how blessed are his sons after him. He walks in his integrity. Now that's what Daniel 6 is talking about. Daniel was faithful in his work. There was no negligence. There was no corruption found in him. What a man. Faithful in his work. I find in the last part of verse 4 yet another mark of integrity, and that is personal purity. We would say today that they tailed him. They examined him carefully, and they discovered after the examination, after checking his private life as well as his work, that there was no negligence, something that should have been done that wasn't, nor corruption, something that should not have been done but was being done. Neither was there. He was a man of personal purity. They could dig all they want. He came out smelling like a rose. Wouldn't you love to hire a person like that? Wouldn't that be great? Continually, I hear from employers, their number one problem is personnel. Not the public, but finding trustworthy personnel. I shared with some of you a number of months ago when I first came across this story of this that happened over in Long Beach, of a fellow who went into a fried chicken place to get some chicken for him and for the woman he was with. She waited in the car as he picked up the chicken and left, and inadvertently the owner, the manager of the store, had placed in the box the proceeds of the day instead of the chicken. And he was going to make a deposit, and he just camouflaged it by putting it in the fried chicken box, and the guy drove away, and they got to the park, and they opened up the box, and they had a box full of money. And that's a very vulnerable moment for the average individual, and that man realized the mistake, got back in his car and drove back to the place and gave him the money back. Why, the manager was so pleased, he said, you stick around. I want to call the newspaper and have them put your picture in. Oh, no, don't do that. Well, why not? Well, he said, you see, I'm married, and the woman I'm with is not my wife. Now, I think that is a perfect illustration of how on the surface we may look like people of great honesty, great integrity. But, you know, when you get back in the car of your private life, you do some investigation. There's a lot of corruption there. Now, Daniel, they found it was incredible. An excellent attitude. Faithfully doing his job at work. An honest man. Third, personally pure. No hypocrisy. Nothing to hide. Now, that so frustrated those that were investigating him. Verse 5 tells us they set up a plan. After this plot began to run its course and they couldn't find an accusation, they then determined that they would have an injunction written against him. Look at how they appealed to the vanity of the king. Then these men said, we shall not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. One thing they had discovered about him when they investigated him is that he was a man of God. They said, look, this man is so consistent in his walk, the only place we're going to trip him up is to use this his faith in God against him. And these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king. Notice, by agreement. It was all a conspiracy. It was a planned, arranged program to sell him down the river. And now they appeal to the vanity of the king. King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, wait a minute, that's a lie. all but one of the commissioners of the kingdom. Daniel didn't know anything about it, but they posed as though Daniel was part of this plan. All of the commissioners, the prefects, the satraps, the high officials, the governors, have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, that's the basis of the lion's den. Found it interesting, just as a sidelight issue, that they didn't want to throw him in a fiery furnace because they were Zoroastrians by faith, the Persian, the Medes were. And they held fire to be sacred. And to have cremated him would have made a god out of him. So many who dedicated their living beings to fire did it as a worship to the gods. They didn't want to put him in the fire because that would be worshiping their god through that sacrifice. So they said, let's put him into a den of lions. Anyone who doesn't worship you for 30 days, it's interesting. We, several years ago, had a program on television called Queen for a Day. They were suggesting that he be the god of the month in this seventh verse. It's exactly what they said. For these 30 days, if anybody worships anyone else but you, O God, O King, they'll be thrown into the lion's den. Now, King, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians. We have that same phrase today. You know how it is, the law of the Medes and the Persians, meaning it will never be changed, which may not be revoked. And so King Darius signed the agreement, that is the injunction. He thought it was a great idea. Naturally, he would. Now, what happened? Remember now our man Daniel, innocent, deserving of none of this, this sneaky conspiracy against him because he had done what was right. Now Daniel, verse 10, when he knew that the document was signed, that's significant. He knew nothing of it, but we're reading in verse 10 of what he did when he first heard about that document. When he knew the document was signed, entered his house. Now in his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God as he had been doing previously. I submit to you that's a most remarkable response to a death warrant. Here I find his fourth mark of integrity, his consistent walk with God. I think the most important part of the 10th verse is the last section, as he had been doing previously. Daniel did not turn to prayer in a time of panic only. He had been consistently on his knees 3 times a day before his God. By the way, remember, he is one of the top officials in the land. And he had time with God regularly. The psalmist writes, evening and morning and noon will I pray and cry aloud, and he will hear my voice. Isn't that a great psalm? Evening, morning, noon, I will pray. Daniel was no stranger to prayer. He didn't flaunt the fact that he was a man of prayer. Notice these windows were open. He didn't suddenly bang them open so everyone would know he was praying. There was an advertisement some time ago from one of the airlines that says, when you've got it, flaunt it. That may work for an airline, but it doesn't work for the child of God. When you've got it, don't flaunt it. Because when you flaunt it, you don't have it. Daniel just quietly walked up to the chamber in his home, and again before God he poured out his fear, his concern, his future, his life. Daniel's almost unreal, isn't he? Just very near unreal. You know something? We we really have a low stress of pain as Christians. When things run along pretty well, we can stay fairly consistent, but when a little ripple comes in the water, suddenly we plunge. And we're back up a little bit when things get a little bit better, and then we may be a little high when things are well, and then suddenly another test comes and we plunge. The remarkable thing about Daniel is that as he had been doing previously, he simply went back to God as though, I think if that had an electrocardiogram, it just would read just same as always, just same as always. Like those astronauts. Just before the blast off, they ran that thing on them, and it just like the morning before when they were having breakfast. What else is new? Going around the earth. Ho-hum. Off they went. And Daniel, well, what else is new? What do you expect from the world? So when he heard about this news, just went right back to God. He told God on them. He had a place to meet. By the way, will you notice that he got on his knees? William R. Newell, he's a quaint expositor, in his writing, suggests that kneeling is a good way to pray because it's uncomfortable. The problem is that we pray in such a comfortable position, we just sort of drift off after a few sentences. But try that. Jim Elliot has said, God is still on his throne and man is still on his footstool. There's only a knee's distance in between. Hey, how's your time in prayer? What does it take to get you on your knees? A tragedy? A real emergency? Well, this man had been doing this as a habit of his life. He had a place to meet with God, and he met. He consistently kept his life and his burdens at the throne. Please don't tell me that you're too busy. Not a person in this building is busier than Daniel could have been as one of the three top men in the land. You can't get more busy than that. But somehow, that priority was so important, he simply stayed before God. I don't think he spent hours there, but I think he spent significant periods of time just punctuating his needs through the day, week in, week out. Well, he had an excellent attitude. He was a man of integrity in that he was faithful at work. There was personal purity, and there was a consistency of walk with God. Now the public arrest came as a result of that godly life. The men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. Isn't that significant? They interrupted him in prayer. That's where they found him. They approached and spoke before the king about the injunction and said, didn't you sign the injunction? The king responds, yes, the statement is true. Daniel, verse 13, one of those in the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, but keeps making his petition three times a day. And suddenly this king who had acted so foolishly and rashly earlier now becomes distressed. Verse 14. He set his mind on delivering Daniel until sunset. He kept exerting himself to rescue him. He had a deep admiration for Daniel, but he couldn't. And then these men came and said, recognize, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and the Persians that no injunction or statute which the king established will be changed. You've got to be a man of your word. And the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. How about that? A more godly influence could not be found in the entire kingdom of Persia, and he was the man who was thrown in the lion's den. Let me share with you three things that I've learned from this passage. The first one is something that all of us can identify with. You will seldom get what you deserve from people. Now that applies to both criticism and honor. When you are genuinely deserving of honor, you will seldom get it from people. And when you are genuinely deserving of criticism, you will seldom get it, as you should. You will seldom get the understanding you should get from people. You'll seldom get the confrontation at the time you need it. Usually you'll get it at the wrong time. When the world administers its approach, it's usually wrong. You'll get promoted when you don't deserve it. You'll often get demoted when it isn't fair. You'll seldom get from people what you deserve, so don't expect it. Don't expect to get what you deserve from your fellow man. Second, you will always get what is best from God. Don't doubt it. The interesting thing about it is that it won't come in the package you expect. And it usually will be delivered late, as your timing works it. You expect God instantly to reward your acts, and He doesn't. He often, after your highest experience, will take you through the deepest valley. And then He will package for you a perfect, best plan. And you'll see it when it's all past. As you look back, it's there. Remember Elijah, when he was brave and strong, courageous, went to the king and said there's going to be a drought in the land. And then he hid out and his brook dried up. After he had made the most courageous move of his life, his brook dried up and he was in a starving condition. But looking back, Elijah could see how perfect God's plan was. You'll seldom get what you deserve from people. Don't expect it. You will always get what is best from God. Don't doubt it, even though it may come slowly. Your ability to handle both is directly related to the consistency of your walk. Now that's the crux of this message. Daniel could handle the final injunction because he had been consistently walking with God. You cannot handle the honors, nor can you handle the tests, if your walk with God is inconsistent. You'll begin to believe your own stuff. You'll begin to think you really are deserving of the honors. Or you will begin to doubt in the midst of the trial because you think you're deserving of something else. Dr. Ralph Byron is one of the most interesting and outstanding Christian surgeons in the Los Angeles area. Early in his medical profession, he sought for a way to make his life count. And professionally and personally, he wanted to be a man of God. He's still living, still has a ministry in the area of Pasadena, Lake Avenue Congregational Church. One day in his search for godliness, he came across Ezekiel 22:30. Which says, I searched for a man among them who should build up the wall and stand in the gap before me for the land, that I should not destroy it, but I found none. Dr. Byron pondered, would God find me standing in the gap? Here he was, a young surgeon, the press of responsibility all around him, and he answered the question, no, not right now. He concluded that at one of those life-changing moments that in order for him to be a man of God, he must continually place a priority on prayer. At first it was very difficult because his duties were extreme. He decided that for him to have time with God, he personally would have to get up very early. He set aside the time of 5:30, which he calls an unearthly hour. But he did it, week in and week out. Remarkable thing he discovered was in a two-week period, he had a quality of life he had never known before. He had seen two men trust Christ, and he also discovered that a major conflict in their church had been dissolved, as he had committed it faithfully to prayer. And so he concluded, and I quote, "It was apparent to me that I must give prayer top priority, even if it means getting less than 6 hours of sleep every night." Now, I'm not standing before you, nor would he, encouraging that you get up at 5 or 5:30. Some of us function a lot better later on and are a lot more effective when we're wide awake. It's not the time of the day. It's that there is a priority every day for God. That's what this is all about. We don't read that Daniel got up at 3 in the morning and prayed till daybreak. We just read that he prayed 3 times a day. There was a priority. And if the truth were known in many of our lives, there is not that priority. And I freely confess that it has not been on a number of occasions in my own life. On one such occasion, I was really burdened. And I was in a disgruntled, gripey old mood. And I decided I would just vent all of my spleen on Bill, take out all my frustration. He'll show you his scars when the service is over. Being a good counselor, he listened to me as I continued to run off at the mouth with all my complaints and all my bad attitude. And he listened and patiently waited until I got through and promised to stand with me and stand by me. Then I turned around to leave, and just over the light switch in his office was this little saying: "When you're faced with a busy day, save precious time by skipping your devotion." Signed, Satan. Well, we had a fist fight that afternoon after that happened. No, as a matter of fact, he doesn't know it to this moment. I asked him tonight to give me that quotation because I wanted to use it. But that day, God used that, because I, for a period of time, had been skipping some time with God. It was terribly important. When faced with a busy day, just save precious time by skipping your devotions. That's what some of you have done. That's why tonight you're very relieved to know that it was Daniel who was placed in the lion's den and not you. Let's bow, shall we? Have you come to the place in your life where you're not getting what you deserve from people? If the truth were known, some of you could say, "That's the story of my life. I have been misunderstood. I have been misused. I have been wrongly criticized. The very ones who criticize me really don't even understand me." Why, as Amy Carmichael said, "If they knew me like I know myself, they would have the most scandalous information to ruin me, for I am so unworthy." It's time this evening to take account of God's hand in your life. Some of you have begun to doubt it. Some of us have begun to let the busy day crowd out our time with God. You can't remember the last time you had a meaningful encounter on your knees, apart from an emergency. No wonder you're having trouble with relationships. No wonder your attitude has been poor at work. No wonder you're having communication problems with your family. No wonder you're suffering from this emptiness of heart at work, at home, within yourself. Daniel had no corner on the marks of integrity. Tonight I challenge you drive a stake in this day. Make plans to meet with God. Don't announce it. Just do it. Be consistent. Watch Him work. Our Father, this evening we find ourselves strangely warmed around the fire of this man's life. We were stopped to think the man was 80, that after a full life of godly living, he was treated like an animal. We are strengthened to think that our lives have been so protected and preserved, while we have deserved so much less than what you have given. Well, we come from the hurt and the bruising and the scars of this world to meet together to hear from you and to join hearts with one another. And we come to say, our Father, that the battle is long and hot and hard. So we ask this evening that you will help us with our priorities. Without playing any kind of numbers game with you, Father, may we just make plans this day to get alone with you and to stay at it. Guard us from panic, especially those who are on the verge of that, from gross disillusionment, for those that have every human reason to feel those things. Keep us from bitterness and resentment, especially those who have come from the frying pan into the fire, from a life of godliness to the dungeon of the lions. May you be far more important to us than any test we are facing. We give you our week with delight. In the name of Christ our Lord. Amen.
The preceding message, The Marks of Integrity, was copyrighted in 1976, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2012 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.